are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, July 14th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Post columnist, editor-at-large of the American Prospect, Harold Meyerson, on the first post-middle-class election. Also on the program today, the Trump GOP convention revealed. Why no Duck Dynasty? Also on the program today, Trump announces he will announce his VP pick tomorrow afternoon. Tomorrow morning, I should say. Note two. There are many things that are prohibited outside the Quicken Loans Auditorium in Cleveland for the RNC. One of them, not actual guns. The new Social Security Trustees report is out. I'm feeling sick. I know what I'm going to be doing tonight, sitting at home, cup of tea. Also, David Sampson, the New Jersey kingpin, if you will, pleads guilty in the Bridgegate case. Very interesting plea, ladies and gentlemen. Meanwhile, new polls show Clinton and Trump tied nationally. And Justice Ginsburg regrets calling Donald Trump more or less an idiot. All that and more on today's program. I should warn you folks, I'm not feeling very well. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I have some type of throat infection. And so I'm going to do my best, and we may head out a little bit early today. But we now have the Republican National Committee schedule. And it is... It's going to be rather interesting, to say the least. They're doing theme nights. That's the way they do this, right? You know, some nights it's like, you'll have how we're going to bring back jobs or strengthen families, or in the case of the Republican convention, of course, you have night one, which is a Benghazi focus. It's not a joke.
For real.
They'll also do a border situation because of that secret trapdoor in Benghazi takes you to the border of Texas. Night two will be a focus on the economy, folks, with, of course, the president of the UFC, which is the ultimate fighting championship league. And Tiffany Trump, among others. Scott Walker will be there.
The less hot daughter will discuss the economy. It's a serious night filled with serious people.
Night three, supposedly one of the nights is going to be a theme focusing on Bill Clinton's infidelities. This is supposedly going to be night, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's night two, but that's the economy. If it's night three, it's going to be a bit of a problem because right now Newt Gingrich is scheduled to be there. You'll recall he led the impeachment efforts until, and then he had to go after it was revealed that he had had multiple affairs, one of which was involving his bedridden, cancer-stricken wife at the time. So that would be awkward in some respects. Ted Cruz, of course, that night too. I mean, maybe they're only putting people who have had infidelities on that night to talk about it, And it'll be, it takes
this
one.
This is a great night, folks.
Takes one to know one. And then, of course, the fourth night kicked off by Tim Tebow. What's he doing now? Is there a Canadian football league?
I don't know what this guy was always thanking Jesus for. I mean, Jesus did not give him much football talent. I mean, it's true.
Rick Scott, he may be doing a rendition of the times he pled the fifth for the Medicaid fraud. Peter Thiel, or Tile, or what the hell is the guy's name again?
Thiel.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone.
I'm going to shut down your...
I just left a Future of Human Harvesting conference to come here. That's how important this is to me.
Folks, there's a home burglary every 13 seconds. I had no idea. It's a little scary. Most of them happen in broad daylight. Burglar rings your doorbell, make sure you're away, then they break in. Ring video doorbell has been proven to stop burglaries before they happen by allowing you to see and speak to anyone approaching your door using your smartphone. Now, Ring is using their advanced motion detection technology to protect your entire property with the Ring security kit. The kit includes a Ring video doorbell for the front door, a Ring stick-up cam, which is a wireless weatherproof HD camera to keep an eye on the other parts of your property, and you can also get, they have an accessory where you can put, where it can be solar, which is huge. Because I played around with this stuff. The batteries will sometimes go out on something that's outside like that because the trees sway, and then all of a sudden. Ring video doorbell, stick-up cam, both install in minutes, and working together provide 24/7 monitoring of your entire home, whether you're in the living room or thousands of miles away. Me personally, I love it because I'm lazy, and I like to see what's going on, and it's awesome. It's very...
As you say, you really want to figure out
what the hell is going on. For a limited time, listeners to this program get $50 off the Ring security kit. It's the lowest price anywhere. Go to ring.com/majority. ring.com/majority. Now, join the hundreds of thousands who protect their home with Ring. Go to ring.com/majority for $50 off. That's ring.com/majority. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Harold Meyerson. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Harold Meyerson. He is a Washington Post columnist, the editor at large for the American Prospect, where you can find his most recent piece, The First Post-Middle Class Election. Welcome back to the program, Harold.
Good to be here, Sam.
So, Harold, so you start off with a story, and I remember when this data came out that a pollster for Democratic candidates told you that he'd begun advising his clients to stop using the words, or at least emphasizing the words, middle class. Why was that?
Well, that was because fewer Americans were thinking of themselves as middle class. And if you talk about helping the broad middle class, which, you know, usually back in the day, most Americans would say, okay, he's talking about me. Actually, significantly fewer Americans think that now. That's both a matter of perception, but also a matter of reality, because surveys have shown really that the middle class has shrunk in two ways. First of all, just the number of people who are not poor or rich has shrunk as really the the middle class is hollowed out. And then the amount of total national income going to people in the middle has shrunk as well. Most of it has been redirected upward. And so this is sort of a, you know, bedrock definition of how Americans thought of themselves in the decades after World War II. But we've had so much hollowing out of the middle of the economy that that's no longer the case.
Well, I mean, what is the definition of middle class in this respect? I mean, I know that's a sort of a, I mean, that's part of the point. But what is the operating definition of middle class?
Well, there are a couple, but when the people at Pew, the Pew Research Institute, came out with their figures, it was people who made within a certain dollar range above and below the national median income.
Okay.
Or median household income, if they're living with a family. So that's basically what it is. Then there's another sense in which I think it's valid to think of the middle class, and that is people who as a condition of their work get adequate health insurance and some kind of retirement security, the kind of stuff that in America, since World War II, has pretty much been the thing that you would expect to come with your job, but that's less and less the case over the last 20, 30 years. And so I think it suggests a level of security which is really no longer there. And in some ways, the most troubling aspect of that is the number of people who are really compelled to work in non-standard employment, compelled to work through temp agencies or as independent contractors, or whether they are or not, or what have you, when, had they been doing the same job 30 years earlier, they actually would have been a regular employee covered under labor laws, which ensure certain wage standards, and where they could expect some benefits. That's less and less the case.
Okay, so you use that that context to look into, and I guess in some ways see where the two parties have responded to this, and in which ways they have, and suggesting where they go from there. So let's start with the Democrats. You talk about two different occasions where the Democrats made some really fundamentally shifted, what they were focused on. And the first one was the New Deal. Walk us through how that happened, because FDR did not enter in necessarily as, you know, a New Dealer. I mean, how did it happen then? And give me a sense of, well, all right, continue. Let's just go there, and then we'll take it from there.
Sure. Sure. Well, the Democratic Party before Roosevelt in the 1920s, before the Depression, before the stock market crash of 1929, was a very different Democratic Party from what we think of today. It was this weird mix of urbanized Americans, many of whom were immigrants or children of immigrants who had come from Southern or Eastern Europe, and the white segregationist South. And so it differed from Republicans, and it differed from itself. There were, as you can imagine, huge tensions within the party over sort of ethnic politics and cultural politics. But it really didn't differ that significantly from the Republicans up until the New Deal. Then the crash happened. The Depression came. And Roosevelt slowly began to redefine what it meant to be a Democrat and a liberal. In his first 2 years, he was kind of really casting about, throwing things at the wall and see what would stick. But there was really increasing militance out in the states, ranging from really disruptive strikes, general strikes in both Minneapolis and San Francisco, where the whole cities closed down for a while, sort of the demagogues of the day, Huey Long, Father Coughlin, pushing some schemes, some of which were quite progressive, some of which were demagogic right. And Roosevelt then moved a couple years into his presidency in 1935, signing really the key pieces of legislation of the New Deal, the Social Security Act, which not only established Social Security, but established unemployment insurance and welfare, and also the National Labor Relations Act, which for the first time gave legal protection to workers seeking to form a union. And that really changed the Democratic Party fundamentally. It basically said, you know, the American economy structurally needs to be altered in order to work, and we're going to change what we believe so that that's the case. And also, by the time he ran for re-election in 1936, Roosevelt was running on, in some ways, the most anti-Wall Street, anti-business platform and rhetoric we've ever seen from a president, you know, including Bernie Sanders, I would say. And he won the most overwhelming election victory in American history.
And we should say, and you note, that one of the features of this was that it was strictly an economic, sort of a broadly speaking, an economic program, but specifically left out, I mean, carved out in many respects, African-Americans and minorities, and to a certain extent, women as well, just by, you know, what professions were going to be subject to a lot of these regulations and whatnot. And then you talk about the next big change in the Democratic Party, which happens in the mid-60s, which in some ways sort of, I guess, 30 years some odd later, addresses those issues at least, or attempts
exactly.
to.
Exactly. Yeah, well, I mean, to you know, Roosevelt's problem was that in order to pass the New Deal programs, minimum wage too, which that was 1938, he had to get the votes of Southern Democrats. And they said, in essence, okay, but we're not extending minimum wage to agricultural workers, which is what most of the African Americans in the South were. And we're not extending collective bargaining rights to agricultural workers. Ditto on that. So, yes, he had to compromise. And the compromises essentially created a whole class of people who were, in a sense, left out of,
right.
Of the New Deal. And then in the 60s, the civil rights movement comes along, and the Democrats respond, and Lyndon Johnson responds, by saying, okay, we understand there are a lot of people left out of really the world we created in the 1930s, and so we're gonna bring them in. We're gonna pass the Civil Rights Act. We're gonna pass the Voting Rights Act. We're gonna create Head Start. We're going to push issues of concern to women. And in a sense, this is what the Democrats have been about since 1964-65. Now, when Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he famously said, I think we've just lost the South, by which he meant the white South, for at least a generation. And boy, was he right. But two things came of this. First of all, the most important thing about this period is that the Democrats still assumed that the New Deal structures and the unions they helped create were permanent, that they didn't, you know, really need to go back and begin to tinker with the fundamentals of the economy. That was a done deal in 1964-65. Prosperity was broadly shared. There was really no reason to do that. And the problem is, over the last 30 years, particularly since 1981, when Ronald Reagan became president, the New Deal sort of nation has eroded. The middle of the economy is gone. Unions have all but vanished from the private sector. And so those assumptions no longer work. Then the other side of that, which we're seeing sort of in the Trump phenomenon, is that it creates in what was once the very base of the Democratic Party, the white working class of the North, it creates a sense that, well, the economy isn't working for us and no one is fixing that. And the Democrats are focusing on minority rights. Now, the Democrats are correct to focus on minority rights. I mean, this is the mission of the party. But I think what we finally see as we chug into 2016 after this history is really, you know, the need for the Democrats to begin to address both of these things. And that's what we've seen in the Bernie Sanders campaign. There's some of that in the Hillary Clinton campaign, beginning to say, okay, we understand the fundamentals of the economy aren't working. And we see it in the Republican Party in the sense that they're doubling down on this sense of white working class decline, something that Nick Consistori writes about on the front, the lead story in the New York Times today, in fact. You know, so the parties have responded in different ways, but I think we're at one of these junctures, like the 1930s and like 1964-65, when changes in the economy and the culture have led to each party redefining itself.
So insofar as that we look back in the 30s and that change, and then the change we saw in the 60s, who gets jettisoned? In other words, if that's going to happen today, who gets jettisoned, and does Hillary Clinton have to be the jettisoner? And can she be? I mean, because it's quite clear how the Republicans have responded to this, right? I mean, they've just gone full on where they've sort of have been, but now they're just coming out and they're being, I think, just exceedingly explicit about it. I mean, the base of the Republican Party has been sort of groomed for Donald Trump for years, it seems to me. And so that's a little bit more obvious. And who's being jettisoned? It's quite clear. Those people who are not as crass, essentially. I mean, it's not an ideological. It is more of like a cultural fight on that side. Who gets jettisoned on the Democratic side?
Well, the Democrats for a long time have been what political scientists might consider an anomaly. They've been a cross-class party. Now, American politics aren't class politics like they are in Europe or many other places. But the Democrats, as the Republicans, have been moving to the right on social and cultural issues for a very long time. A lot of upper middle class and even upper class people have had it with the Republican Party. And so you get people who used to be called Rockefeller Republicans moving into the Democratic ranks, including on Wall Street. That's sort of the Robert Rubin people who really dominated economic policy during the last two Democratic presidencies, that of Bill Clinton and that of Barack Obama. Although I'd say in the last year in particular, Obama has taken a much more labor-friendly turn to the extent that he can through executive orders and the Labor Department and NLRB rulings. I think a lot of what the Sanders campaign was about was kind of almost of a challenge to the party generally and Hillary Clinton in particular, which was, look, we can't meet the demands of our base, of our constituents, with a program that's still friendly to Wall Street. We have to tax financial transactions. We have to raise taxes progressively. We have to break up the big banks. We have to diminish the role of big money in politics. And so really, that's been a challenge, to put it mildly, for Hillary Clinton, who I think actually, you know, intellectually understands this. But it requires, a breaking of ties, because Lord knows, in particular, what the party has done in some ways. And if you look at the Democratic platform, you can see this in there, is it's really repudiated a lot of the basic policies of her husband's presidency, the deregulation.
The call for a 21st century Glass-Steagall Act, which is essentially we want to make up for that mistake.
And then on trade, it's been very interesting because, yes, it's true that the Democratic Platform Committee meeting last weekend did not repudiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But if you look at what passed, it repudiated the contents of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It said, we don't want private courts, which are always a part of these things, ruling in corporation versus country disputes. We don't want these deliberations going on in secret, which is always how they work. So there's really a moving away from the Democratic Party, where Wall Street played a dominant role. But this is still a work in progress. And if you look at what Hillary Clinton needs to do if she's going to win this election, you know, I mean, she's got to carry some Rust Belt states where Donald Trump's rejection of trade deals is much stronger than hers, and that's a very politically potent issue in those places.
And so just to touch on the Republicans post-Trump, if there is a post-Trump, I mean, we have a poll out today that shows Clinton and Trump neck and neck. I'm still keeping hope alive, as it were. But but just, I mean, let's say a post-Trump world, okay? You know, what does the Republican Party do? Like, you know, it just seems to me that there's no room for them to reform. I mean, if anything, this is just sort of like has raised the bar, if you will, or just lowered it. I don't know how to really sort of like graph this out, but has created an expectation amongst the base of the Republican Party. Like, we're no longer putting up with this nice speak anymore. We want you to be explicit. We don't like brown people, or, you know, maybe I'm exaggerating ever so slightly, but it seems to me it's going to be hard for them to accept, you know, Paul Ryan trying to pretend like he's being nice after this.
No, I think you're right. And I think there's a real, I mean, you know, I think the Republican Party is in a degree of existential crisis because, you know, Trump has raised or lowered the bar, as you put it, so that candidates are expected to sound like shock jocks. And, you know, you will see a number of people who have been leading Republicans, quite a number, staying away from the Cleveland Convention because that ain't them. Even though they've supported things like restricting minority voting any way they can. So I don't know that there are really, you know, that many programmatic differences in the Republican Party. Though, you know, the Trump stuff on immigrants and Muslims does go beyond what we thought of as conventional Republicanism.
Right.
But the manner and the substance, but even, you know, forget the manner for a minute. Let's say Trump is defeated. I'm sure there'll be, you know, a successor generation who may not talk like him, but who still have his policies. Ultimately, you know, that's a real problem for the party in a nation that grows, you know, steadily less white with each passing year. So whatever the outcome of this year's election, and I, like you, am trying to keep hope alive, the demographics are just not good for a white nationalist party, which is what the Republican Party has become.
Let me ask you one final question, Harold. You know, this is. I read a lot of think pieces, right, about how we hear some of the more reasonable Democrats and I guess reasonable people. And, you know, people would generally say we need a functioning Republican Party in this country. Now, I don't happen to believe that. I happen to believe we can have a different party. But we need a functioning Republican Party. They have moved far too much to the right. If we accept at least that premise, isn't part of the responsibility that the Democratic Party had basically moved too far to the right itself and had stolen the center? In other words, doesn't the Democratic Party have a responsibility if people genuinely believe that we need to have a two-party, to have our system functioning well, that the Democrats have to move to the left and have to jettison some element of what has been their coalition, right? Because they had people captured on the left because there was nowhere else to go. And they had moved so far into the center, if you will, or to the right, that, you know, as a way of raising money or whatnot. But now you know, it's clear that there's an alternative method in which to raise money, at least a significant money. Don't the Democrats have a responsibility almost to the country? I mean, this sounds maybe silly to say, but to move to the left and jettison part, to give the room for Republicans to move towards the center.
I would say they have a responsibility to do that, whether or not you think the Republican Party needs to shape up, because the Democrats can't advocate for the people they, you know, express concern for, minorities, workers, et cetera, unless they move to the left. And, you know, I do think this year so far in the Democratic Party has seen some of that, which we see in the platform, in, you know, the size of the Sanders vote, and in the shifting positions leftward of Hillary Clinton. I mean, when Hillary Clinton has changed her position in the course of her campaign, it's not been moving to the center, it's been moving more to the left of where she started out. So I think that is a work in progress, but if the party is going to thrive, it has to be, you know, pushed further. It has to be a continuing work in progress, and I can only hope that that's going to happen.
And I'm sorry, I don't mean to steal one more question from you, but that move word leftward, left, in your experience, is that typical? In other words, there's a lot of people out there and I who say, like, well, I don't believe what Hillary Clinton's saying anyways. But isn't just the fact that she feels as a politician, if you want to get as cynical as possible, that she feels as a politician that she has to, even if you want to be cynical, pretend to move to the left. Doesn't, what does that tell us? Isn't that...
Well, it tells us, you know, pretty much what I'm saying in this piece, that the massive changes in the United States and in the American economy make this politically imperative for the party to move in this direction. It's not just Hillary. You see things like an op-ed that ran in the both the Financial Times and the Washington Post by Larry Summers, essentially saying, look, you know, we were really wrong on this free trade stuff. We really need to protect our own. You see it in the work of Clinton-esque center-left think tanks like the Center for American Progress, which started about a year ago putting out papers about, you know, really we need to make it much easier to get into unions. So, I mean, it's not simply the evolution of Hillary Clinton. I think this whole center of the Democratic Party understands that if they want to hold power, they do have to move to the left. So that's one reason why I'm modestly hopeful.
Harold Meyerson, columnist for The Washington Post, editor-at-large of The American Prospect, on his piece, The First Post-Middle-Class Election. Thanks so much for your time today. I hope we can see Evan Bayh show up and announce his candidacy wearing a Che Guevara T-shirt. That would give me
indeed,
the ultimate confidence that we're seeing that move to the left.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you, Harold. Man. Bye-bye. That would be great, wouldn't it? Evan Bayh is just like, dude, I'm your man.
I get how it works.
I get it.
I mean, there's many different cycles of revolutions. So several years ago, it was advocating for pharma, but that's because of the dialectical nature of moving America towards the communist endpoint.
Believe me, I have spent the past 5 or 6 years as a corporate lobbyist to find out their weak underbelly.
And I found it. I don't know how they
work. I found it. I have found it. And I have used every dollar that I have made as that corporate lobbyist, and I have put it in an account in the Caymans that is going to buy weapons and provide uniforms and food that is buried at different
points. I would grow a beard if I could.
From Indiana to Washington, D.C., and we're going to take over the government.
Meanwhile, Bernie, completely always committed to being out of sync with the times. Now, all of a sudden, he's going, we need to reach across the aisle.
That's right.
He's so committed to not being in the mainstream that now he's going to become a reinvented third way.
Turns out Bernie's just a contrarian.
Well, now that everybody wants to do something about poor people, let me say this. Maybe they should take some responsibility for the stake their own lives.
How about we stop demonizing the job makers? All right.
I think everybody knows we have to have a safety net. It just can't be a hammock.
All right. I don't feel well, folks. I'm sorry. We're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half. Oh, I wanted to tell you this, though. You know, Michael, how we have MajorityReportKickback.com. And if you go to that link, and what you find there is you find a link to Jet.com or a link to Amazon.com, and you purchase your Amazon or Jet.com goods through there. Now, everybody knows what Amazon is. Not many people know what Jet is. I mean, a lot do, but not as many. You can buy grocery items through Jet.com. Did you know this, Matt? I know that this is interesting to you because you fashion your entire life around being lazy. I mean, with all due respects, you work very well.
It's smart laziness.
You're a great, yes, you have a very, let me restate that, because that's not true, because you actually are a tireless worker. But you will avoid anything that you think is inefficient.
Correct.
That's so laziness is not the right way to say it. So in other words, like that story about cereal. You'll avoid cereal because you don't want to have to clean the bowl.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is why, incidentally, for your Christmas bonus, you're going to be getting those small Kellogg's boxes of cereal that you can actually cut, pour the milk into.
It's a little bit better.
Throw that away. But you can have your grocery. You wouldn't have to shop. You could just have them delivered to you. And you get 20% off of all your grocery items with a minimum purchase of $75. So you buy a bunch of stuff that, you know, will last for a while. I mean, you don't have kids, so you're not going to go through that type of food. Save Fresh 20 is the promo code. So you go to MajorityReportKickback.com, click through that link, use Save Fresh 20, and that's good to the end of this month. And if you're a new shopper, use the code TRIPLE15. We'll put these up at that link and in our on the front page of the site. TRIPLE15, you get 15% off your first three orders at Jet. Crazy, man. Crazy. So MajorityReportKickback.com, however you shop, you should stop there first. Click the link, bookmark it, always use that as your Jet.com or your Amazon link, and then you are golden. And of course, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And as always, it's your membership that makes the show possible. It's expensive to go to Philly. Like, the hotels are extremely pricey. Couldn't afford to get a wired system. I mean, the amount of money they were charging, it was very complicated. But it was like $2,600 just to get electricity and an internet connection inside Radio Row. But I think I figured out another technology where we can do it. But either way, it is your support as members which allow us to do these type of things and to do the show on a daily basis. Next week, we could end up doing literally 25 hours of show next week.
Catherine, you may very well get sick of it.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have so much show, it's going to make you sick. If you have any inclination to watch any of the RNC, you're going to want to watch it with us. We will have correspondents on the floor of the Republican National Convention. Catherine Harris, former Secretary of State who brought us George Bush. Apparently she's still alive. She's going to be on the convention floor. Right-wing Mandela, he's going to be calling in from the convention floor. It's crazy. Bernie Sanders may call in from the convention floor. We have no idea.
A new roving correspondent for MSNBC.
That's right.
Sort of a general policy analyst.
I don't know. We haven't quite figured this out. We don't know if we're going to do shows at noon next week, or we're going to blow that off and do shows later for the RNC and just live stream it all. And have interviews, you know, because it's not all going to be compelling. I mean, Tim Tebow's speech is going to be really interesting, but it's not going to be...
That guy's a bot. Trust me. It's true.
So we're still working that out. We're going to figure it out. But all of this, folks, takes time and work. And if you enjoy it and you're listening to the show a couple of times a week, why not become a member? You might enjoy the second half. You may just sit back and say, I can feel good about myself because I actually make this work. We don't live in an era anymore where it's like the stuff you like gets canceled by some network because it's supported by you. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number.